My name's Cortland. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is January 29th, 2002. Midtown Group of Alcoholics Anonymous is my home group, and I have a sponsor, and I have been graced with the ability to sponsor other men in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm grateful to be down here. I'm grateful to show up and do something that I was asked to do. And I say that because that's not what I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. Showing up and doing what I said I was going to do is not what I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. And just in kind of opening, I walked in, I saw Billy in the parking lot, we went and got something to eat, I came back, I walked in, we talked for a couple minutes. And Billy told me a minute ago, he said, "We don't open up with much. We're going to say a couple quick words and then you're going to be up." Now, I heard him say it, I understood the words he said, but I was still surprised when I was asked to say it. So with that, you understand that I still think I know. No matter where I go, no matter what I'm doing, first time, last time, I still think I know something. But I'm definitely grateful to be here. And I'm tasked with telling you, the literature tells me that if I get a chance to share, I should tell you in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. And I'll do my best to do that. And if I stray too far from my experience, then I'm going to apologize now. If I start to get into my opinion about a lot of things, then it's kind of a waste of time. Because I've got a lot of opinions, and they're not worth much. I will probably read a couple of things out of the literature, but the one thing that I definitely want to read, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, or even if you've been here for a while and you get nothing out of anything I say, I'd like to read one thing from the foreword of the 12 and 12. And it says, "AA's 12 steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole." And for me, that's the truth. If I try to practice these principles and the principles that I've learned in the steps through the example of my sponsor and through the example and the accountability of my home group, then I've found myself to be in a position where I'm happily and usefully whole. And going back to what I said a minute ago, that's not what I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was almost 27 years old. I wouldn't have told you that I was an alcoholic. I would have probably admitted either during or after a meeting when crying, because that's what I did when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I cried, that I was hopeless. But I'm not sure that I would have said I was an alcoholic. And when I mentioned that I cried, I did, I cried. I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was almost 27 years old, and I'll get in more into the circumstances of that, but in a meeting, if I felt like I had something to say and I raised my hand, or somebody called on me in a meeting, I invariably cried for my first 9 months sober. Not a little whimpering, we're talking about snot and tears, because life without a drink was unbearable when I got here. Life without a drink was completely unbearable. We've got a common friend, Jack. Jack is actually noted in my early sobriety for calling on me in meetings. He'd say, "And now Cortland's going to cry." Cortland. Sure enough. But for me, by the time I got here, there wasn't the crying and the feelings of difference and not sure that I was an alcoholic weren't enough to keep me away from you guys. And the big reason for that was that I had destroyed everything in my life. And to be honest, I'm grateful for that today. I'm grateful for the fact that there wasn't much doubt in my mind when I got here that I couldn't do it by myself. And I've had the chance to sponsor some guys that aren't quite sure of that when I get here. So I'm grateful for the fact that that's the case with me. And before the meeting, Billy asked how my dad was, and they know each other. My dad is not a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He's not an alcoholic. He still doesn't understand these meetings or what we do. He's been to a couple of my anniversaries, and like I said, I'm almost 9 years sober. He doesn't understand the meetings. Doesn't make sense to him. But he and Billy had a chance to hang out for a day, not too long ago, and they had a blast, and my dad loves them. Loves you. Thinks you're a great guy. Always wants to know how you're doing to make sure things are all right. And I'm riding down here tonight in the car with Christian. And I said, I'm going to Billy Hill's group down in Madison. So he sent his hellos. And that, we were at a, I'm kind of, I'm kind of all over the place, and I'll kind of get it together in a minute here. But we were at an anniversary last night. Arno celebrated 20 years recently, and so we had a dinner, and we were at a community center. We had a dinner. The guys he sponsored made some food, and we sat around, had a dinner, and then we had a roast for Arno. And there are a lot of people talking about their experience with Arno over the last 20 years. Some of the guys that got sober with him, they've been friends with him the whole time. And I got to sit there, and I got to watch all this. And for 9 years, I've been a part of the lives of all these people. And I knew what they were talking about when they were talking about situations. And I knew what they were talking about when they were talking about Arno working with other guys. And I'd had those experiences with Arno. And I was really kind of, I really felt happy to be a part of that. And not only a part of it in that I was sitting there eating dinner, but the fact that I was a part of that for the last 9 years. Like, I'm a part of what goes on there. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I wasn't a part of anything. My family refused to leave me, but I definitely wasn't a part of that family. Any personal relationships I had, whether I called them friends, whether they were girlfriends or they were guys I ran around with, I was not an active participating member in those relationships. I was definitely not the guy at work that people were looking to get stuff done. I wasn't a part of anything. And that is, for me, is some of the loneliness that I felt that it describes in our literature. You hear a lot of people talk about in terms of the alcoholic loneliness. I was miserable, and I wasn't a part of anything. And I got to you people, and you guys looked happy, and you looked like you had something going on, and I wasn't even sure if I wanted that, but you looked better than I felt, so I kept coming back. My parents were, my dad came down and spent the day with Billy. They were working on some stuff. My dad, as a hobby, races cars, and that's been going on my whole life. And they were active people, lots of parties, lots of friends. We'd always be out and about. They were social. They did a fair amount of drinking. So I can't tell you when I took my first drink. I was a kid running around, cleaning stuff up, finishing sips here and there. I'm sure people gave me sips here and there. I'm sure my parents gave me sips here and there. And I can't tell you when I took my first drink. I sipped on alcohol here and there, and that was kind of whatever. But I can clearly remember and tell you about the first time I got drunk. Growing up, my parents did everything they could for me. I did not need for anything. Did I want for things? Yes. I was a selfish kid growing up, just as much as I was a selfish alcoholic when I got here. I wanted for things. And some of the things that I forget when I was growing up is come birthday or come Christmas or something like that, you'd get presents. Father, mother, I have an older sister, and we'd get presents. Invariably, after whatever the main event was, whether it was my birthday or Christmas, my mother and father would separately pull me aside, not in front of my father, or not in front of my mother, not in front of my sister, and I would get an extra gift or something. And they'd say, don't tell them about that. Don't tell them about that. And I kind of forget about that in telling my story, but somehow they knew I wanted more. And they were also willing to do it. They gave me more. So I can't say I wanted for anything. Well, not that I needed for anything. I was getting much more than I ever needed. But I invariably, around the holidays, I kind of remember that. I kind of remember being pulled aside as a kid. My dad would buy me some ice skates, or he bought me a bicycle. I remember my father and mother didn't talk one year for a couple months after my birthday because of the money my father spent buying me a bicycle that my mother didn't think I needed. So it's like they gave me everything they possibly could have. And as I destroyed those relationships growing up, my father and my sister were still there constantly trying to make sure I had everything I needed. So it wasn't a lack of love and support of the people around me that got me drinking. And I definitely want to clear that up. But so growing up, my friends started drinking a little bit before I did. The guys I ran around with. And I ran around with some guys my age, and I ran around with some guys that were a couple of years older. And they started drinking before I did. The two guys I went to this party with were probably drinking for about 6-8 months before I started drinking. And one of those guys was my age. I was 13 years old. He was 13 years old. And he had started drinking maybe 6 or 8 months before me. But we're going to this party with some high school kids. And this is before I was going to go to high school. So we're going to a party with some guys I look up to, some kids I got to go to school with next year. I look up to them, some girls I'm attracted to. I'm 13 years old, so we're interested in the girls. And I got to, I don't know if I lied to get to the party or I snuck out of the house, but it was one of the two. And we end up going to this party, and this girl's having a party, and all the kids are packed in the house, and I can remember where I was. I was downstairs in the basement. The stairs were came down, and they were open. So there was the open area between the stairs, and I was standing there with my back up against the stairs. I'm not comfortable. I want to keep everybody else out in front of me. And I'm just standing there, and I'm watching some people dance, and people are talking, and everybody's running around with red plastic cups, and I got my back up against the wall. That's where I feel comfortable. One of the guys I was with said, "Do you want a drink?" And I said, "Yeah." I mean, everybody else was drinking, so I'm not going to say no. I'm not going to be different. Now, I will tell you, these guys have been drinking for 6 or 8 months ahead of me, and I thought to myself, for what? Like, why are they drinking? What's the point? And that's because I wasn't doing it, and I thought, why do they need to do it? They're wrong. Once again, anything that I was doing is different than what you were doing. You were obviously wrong, and I was right. They offered me a beer, and everybody else was drinking out of the red plastic cup, so I said, I'll have a beer. And somebody brought me a beer, and I had a beer, and I had another beer, and I had about 5 or 6 beers that night. Now, 5 or 6 beers at the end of my drinking would have pissed me off. I would have been pretty angry. But 13 years old, having not drunk too much up to that point, 5, 6 beers, I got drunk. I got drunk, and all of a sudden I could talk to people, and things were okay, and my back wasn't up against that wall anymore. And just for me, just for my personal experiences, like a lot of the places I ended up drinking, that event turned out a little different than it started. The girl that was having the party, somebody punched her in the face. Party's over. Everybody get out. So now all the kids that were in this house that were drinking were now thrown out in the middle of the street. So we're all out in the middle of the street, and me and the two guys I'm with, we end up getting in a fight. We ended up getting in a fight with about 7 or 8 guys, and we got beat up. So, and then that fight got broken up when the police showed up with dogs. So I'm 13 years old. My parents are relatively strict. I just got beat up by guys I have to go to school with next year in front of girls that I'm kind of attracted to that I'm trying to impress. The cops are running around with dogs, and you would think there should be a lot of problems at that point. There should be a lot of problems going on. And honestly, I walked home with those two guys and we laughed and joked the whole way. It was hilarious. It was a blast. And for me, that's the sense of ease and comfort produced by alcohol that it describes in the book. I could care less. I'm going home to my parents. They're probably going to be pissed. I'm drunk. I'm late. I'm beat up. But there wasn't a thing wrong in the world. And at 13 years old, there really wasn't anything wrong in the world. I mean, that was a problem night, but there really wasn't anything wrong in the world. Now, by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a lot more wrong in the world. A lot of that created by me. But alcohol still did the same thing for me. I'm not one of the people that says alcohol stopped working for them. I don't believe that to be true. I'm not here to tell you anybody else's experience. But in my experience, if I get far enough away from doing what I'm doing here and get enough chaos going on in my head, enough twists in my stomach, I know if I go out and take a drink, it's going to do the same thing for me. That sense of ease and comfort will be produced by alcohol. And I know that that'll happen. But I also know today that I've got no control over how much I take and how long I'm going to drink and what I'm going to do to get drunk. But that night I experienced that sense of ease and comfort. And I'm not one of the people that says I decided at that point this is what I was going to do for the rest of my life. But if you look at what happened in my life starting at that point, I was 13 years old. My mother was a heavy drinker. She did a lot of drinking. When I was 16 years old, my mother passed away as a result of her drinking. She did a lot of drinking. But me and my mom were the best of friends. I spent in elementary school, probably maybe even up until middle school, I'd spend 3-4 days a month home from school just hanging out with my mom, running around. We'd go to one store. She'd write a check for 50 over, get some cash. We'd go by Rodman's, pick up a couple bottles of wine, come home. Mom would have some wine, and I'd hang out. This was a good day for me. I didn't have to go to school. But I was really close with my mother, and And my father worked to make sure everything went well in that house and make sure that we had food and we had gifts and the rent was paid and we had a place to stay. And at that point, when I started drinking, my perception of them changed. And my perception of my situation changed. And not too long after that, it may have been 2 or 3 months, I can remember sitting on my bed having a discussion with my mother about the fact that I needed to go out that night. I'm 13 years old. I need to go out this night. And those same guys I was drinking with before were going out drinking that night. And I can remember talking to her, and I can remember tapping my hand on the wall. And I'm tapping my hand on the wall trying to make my point. I'm trying to make my point. I'm trying to make my point. And I finally decide, this is not getting through, and I'm not going to make it out of the house to drink tonight. And I put my hand through the wall. Just 13 years old, and I put my hand through the wall because I knew I wasn't going to get drunk that night. Now, that first night at that party, I might not have said, this is what I'm going to do with the rest of my life. But a couple months later, having started to consume alcohol more regularly, there was something inside me that knew I needed to drink. And like I said, things started changing. I started drinking as much as I could, which was more and more frequently. That the guy that was 13 that I said I drank with at that first party, his family lived 3 doors away, and they didn't care if he drank. There were certain rules, like you got to be in the house if you're drinking, you can't be out drinking, and those rules even changed. But I always had access to alcohol either at his house or running around with the guys I was running around with. And as I started to drink more, I found guys that were drinking more. Or I found guys that were willing to drink with kids that were 13 years old. And if you're doing that, there's generally a lot of other stuff going on. And shortly thereafter, I relate to something my grand sponsor says. It's an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and I respect our singleness of purpose. What I will say is any drugs that came within this close to me while I was drinking, I did. I'm also a diabetic. I was diagnosed with diabetes when I was 10 years old. And alcohol, anybody knows anything about alcohol, diabetes, alcohol will raise your blood sugar to kind of shut your body down. And I found enough things this close to me that would allow me to stay up and drink as long as I wanted. So I did a lot of that. But I'm running around drinking with guys, and slowly we have some problems. I'm not showing up where I'm supposed to be. I'm not doing the things I'm supposed to do, and there's some problems starting to happen. And then, like I said, when I was 16 years old, my mother passed away as a result of her drinking. And just to show the progression, by the time I was 16, I was drinking every day. I was running around with guys. We were actually making fake IDs. We're pretty good at it, and we were making money, so I had an ID that said I was 21. I had money because we were selling these IDs, so I drank what I wanted. I was 16 years old. I was drinking every day. There was a certain store that we went to after school, and I remember walking in one day, and the owner's wife ID'd me and my friend, and he came out of the back, and he hit her. He just hit her and told her to get away from the register. Because we were such regular customers of his that he was mad that she was questioning us about buying alcohol. And I was 16 years old. And that's how much time we spent going in there getting alcohol. But at 16 years old, I come home from school one day, and if I had spent the whole day at school, and I think I did that day, I come home from school, mother's kind of sick, she's laying on the couch, she doesn't feel well. I talk to her for a couple of minutes, and I go out. I got to go get something to drink. And I go out, and I hang out with my friends for a while, get a little bit to drink. I come back a couple hours later, and she's still laying on the couch, and she's not doing well. So I call my father, and he comes and gets her, and he takes her to the hospital. And we find out that night that she's pretty sick. I didn't have all the facts, but she was pretty sick. And what happened over the next 7 days for me is a true example of where I had gotten in my drinking in 3 years. I would get up the next day and I'd go to school. I'd start out at school and then I'd go get drunk. My father would have to track me down during the day somewhere. And he would track me down and he would find me and then he would take me to the hospital to see my mother. And that happened every day for 7 days. And then at the end of those 7 days, my mother passed away. But I couldn't even show up for that. I couldn't not drink for that. And And I was 16 years old at the time. I mean, I'd only been drinking for 3 years. Like I said, I didn't get here until I was almost 27. So there was a lot more. There was a lot more drinking that went on. There was a lot more. But that's one of those situations where, like I said, when I was 13 years old, there's nothing I really need to forget. There's nothing really I need to calm down. There's nothing I really need to settle in my stomach other than the mania that's going on in my head. But now I'm starting to create things that I need to forget. And in the book, it talks about alcoholism being progressive and fatal. And my understanding of some of the progression is I start to create these scenarios that I then need to forget. I start to make the drama that I need to shut up in my head so I can lay down and go to sleep at night or pass out at the end of the day. And my mother passed away, and for me, I was drunk every day up until the day she passed away. I was drunk every day after that. There wasn't any break for me. I was in school the day after she passed away. I was back in school. My sister just kind of stopped functioning for a while. She was out of school for a couple of weeks. My father, I think, stopped going to work for a while. And me, I got up and went to school the next day. I don't think I spent the whole day there when I got drunk. And just kept on trudging through. Like I said, I continued to drink. I'm still drinking. Less than a year later, actually, interestingly enough, less than a year later, I take some tests, some college tests, some SATs or whatever, and based on how I score on those SATs, I make the local paper for how well I scored on those SATs. And less than 6 months later than that, I'm arrested for possession with the intent to distribute with a friend, could have got some jail time for that. So we're looking at the scope of things that are happening. And I get arrested, and that's another one of those scenarios where my dad's just trying to figure out, like, what's going on in your head? Like, what are you thinking? What's happening with you? And I can remember years before that, I remember stealing something and getting caught, and my mother having to come pick me up where I stole something. I'm handcuffed to a chair when she gets there, and she's screaming and yelling and fighting with people, asking, this is a kid, what's wrong with you? Why do you have him handcuffed? What are you thinking? And then in the car, her asking me the same question, like, what are you thinking? Like, what's going on? What are you thinking? I can remember even earlier than that. I was probably in elementary school, and some middle school kids were having a party up the street. And I grew up on a street that had a court on the top of the hill, and they were having a party. And I wanted to get in with some of my friends. They were drinking in that party. Now, this was before I had started drinking. But there was drinking going on in that house. And I wanted to go in, and they wouldn't let us in. And they kind of made fun of us and told us to get away. So I went around back, and I grabbed their garden hose. And I stuck it in the window of the house, and I turned it on. And I left. And then a couple hours later, apparently I had flooded that room. And three of the biggest guys that were in that party came running out of the house and chased me down the street to my house. And all 5 foot nothing of my mother came running out the front door with a broomstick and chased those three guys back up the street. And it was, I say this stuff just to say that there wasn't any lack of love and support in my house that drove me to do the things that I did. And as I destroyed those things, there was more than I needed to drink to cover up. The literature says deep down inside every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. And I wasn't raised in the church. I wasn't raised going to church. And today, as an alcoholic, going to meetings, I spend more time in church than most people I know. but for me, that fundamental idea of God was I was raised with a very good understanding of right and wrong. And I knew what was right and I knew what was wrong. I knew what I was doing was wrong. And as I continued to live that way, I needed more to drink, to shut up the voices in my head and to calm down my stomach. And it continued to get worse. I had that arrest. I ended up graduating from high school. I applied to three colleges only because my father and a guidance counselor at school demanded that I do so. I got into all three schools that I applied to. I wanted to go to the closest school to home, where I knew most of my friends were going. My dad wanted me to go the farthest away because he knew my friends were going closest to home. So we compromised, and I went to the school in the middle, distance-wise. And truly, that's the only reason I went there. I went to the school in the middle closest distance-wise. And that's because I thought I could get home and drink with the friends at the closer school. And I ended up drinking plenty at my school, and I actually spent a lot of time at the school that was farthest away because they were doing a lot of drinking there, so I went there. What I got out of 3 years of school was a pretty hefty bill. I still pay $77.34 a month paying off that bill. I did not get a degree. I didn't get any good grades. I didn't learn much. I was the guy sleeping on the furniture in the university center. But I drank. I drank a lot and had a blast. If you get the effect produced by alcohol that I did, which like I said, it allows me to calm down. It allows me to interact with you. It allows me to feel like I'm a part of. Then in a social situation like college, drinking allows you to make some friends. I had a good time. I had a good time. Once again, I wasn't doing anything in school, so I'm feeling bad about that. I'm spending, my dad paid for as much as he could on loans, and I took out the rest. Actually, we reversed that. He had more sense than that. I took out as much as I could in loans, and what I couldn't cover in loans, he paid for the remainder. So I know that I'm spending his money and not getting anything done. He gave me a bank card to his bank account when I went up there and said, here, yours, here's the PIN number. We agreed on an amount of money that I was allowed to take out so I could survive. I subsequently got two jobs up there that he didn't know about because I definitely needed more than he was giving me so I could drink. So I actually had two jobs he didn't know about so I could have more money to drink, and I also definitely took more money than he had allotted for me. That comes up later in my story because the PIN number was his birthday. And years later, I'm drinking at the beach, and I haven't been in college in years, and he's never taken that card back from me. And years later, I'm drinking at the beach, and I can't remember my father's birthday to take money out of the bank. I don't even know when his birthday is. And so I'm up there drinking for a while in college, and I come home, and I came home and I got a job before I told my dad that I was not going back to school because I figured that might be a better chance of him keeping me in the house and not throwing me out if I had a job. So I get a job, and I start going to work, and I'm working for a couple weeks, and he kind of starts doing the math, and he's like, when does school start? And I said, it started last week, and I said, I'm not going back. And we didn't talk for a little while because of that, but I started working, and I started working a retail job based in commission, and there are a lot of things about alcoholics that the book states. There's also a couple of things I know. Alcoholics do great in commission sales, because they can do the math, and I was able to sell things to make money so I could drink, and that's the way it was when I started working. However, shortly thereafter, I was working at work. I was stealing money from my employer. I was stealing money from my family. I was stealing money from my girlfriend. I was running around doing things. I was an entrepreneur on the side, not much of one, just enough that I could have money to drink and to get the other things that I wanted, And my world started becoming smaller and smaller, smaller and smaller. And Christian and I were joking. We were telling stories on the way up, and there are a lot of stories, a lot of things that happened in my drinking, and we were joking about this. And you tell some of these stories, and definitely outside of Alcoholics Anonymous, but even sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous, and people are like, "Come on, that can't be true. That did. There's no way that really happened." And, "No, yeah, it actually did. That's how I lived." And we were joking that if we could actually come up with this without it actually happening, then we'd have great careers in Hollywood. But there was a lot going on, and there was a guy I worked with at one point, and I remember we were out drinking one night, and he said, "Corwin, your stories are so funny. Your stories are so funny." And I was like, "Jake, that's my life." And it was even at that point I saw that some of this stuff just wasn't adding up, and it didn't make much sense. But I was destroying the relationships around me. Me and my sister were living in the same house together. Prior to me getting sober, my mother had passed away when I was 16. My father was in and out of several relationships. At one point, he had another woman move into the house, and I know she moved out shortly thereafter, and that relationship ended based on the fact that my father was still willing to support and take care of me. And I know that didn't sit well with her. She made several offers of choices I had about where I could go other than that house. And I didn't even acknowledge she was speaking, and my father didn't acknowledge she was speaking either. And I think that's what ended that relationship. And subsequently, a couple years after that, my father was in another relationship, and he ended up moving out of the house. So now I'm, I don't know, mid-20s, early-20s. I'm living rent-free in a house where my father's putting food in the fridge, where I'm living with my sister. I am working a full-time job and getting a full-time check. And like I said, I'm still stealing from everybody around me so I can drink and live the way that I want to live. And by this point, like I said, I'm lying and cheating and stealing from everybody. I'm stealing from my employers. I'm stealing from my family. Prior to me coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, my sister had gotten into a relationship. She had had a child. His father had moved in for a while, so it was me, my sister, my nephew, and my nephew's father living there for a while, and then he had subsequently moved out. My sister is collecting public assistance to raise my nephew. My dad's helping out there. I'm stealing money from her so I can go drink the way that I want to drink. There are holes punched and kicked in the walls of that house based on the way that I would act with my sister. Generally sober, because that's when I'm most uncomfortable. That's when I can't deal with life. Give me a couple of drinks, and even though you're attacking me and telling me I'm an idiot and a fool and I need to change the way I live, I've got a couple of drinks, and I foresee more in the future. I don't care too much. It doesn't bother me too much what you have to say. And I'm running around with guys. I'm running around with guys that are drinking and doing the other stuff that I'm doing. And it's at that point. While I'm doing it, it's still not that bad. But what's happening is there's times when I wake up or I come to in the afternoon or I'm without a drink for a period of time are becoming more and more unbearable. More and more unbearable. And I'd love to point at individual things and say that this is the reason I got sober. This is the reason that I got sober. Because some people have an incident happen and it sheds some light on the situation. It clears them up enough that they can get here enough. And like I said, I had had a couple of arrests. My father and I were at the point where we would have conversations. People point out that I'm the only one that calls these conversations because he would have my collar and he'd pull me in close and he'd be yelling and there's nothing I could do. But those were the conversations we were having. My sister and I were at each other's throats all the time. Like I said, I was stealing from my girlfriend. For whatever reason, she didn't leave me. I was physically violent with her on occasion, and that's another one of those things that, it's one of those things, Frank, you know him well, I know he's come down here to speak before, he was one of the first people to tell me about Pig and Steak. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, he was down at 22nd and P, and he was talking from the stage, and he said he was physically violent with his wife. He said he hit her. He said, that's not something I'm proud of, but those are the facts. And people that were here before me that said those things, that expressed those stories, but still stood up, that were able to hold their head high, is one of the things that made me feel like it was okay here. And I was physically violent with her, generally when she would come between me and a drink. One night in particular, I can remember, we were at a party somewhere, and I think earlier in the night, a girl that I was unfaithful with my girlfriend with had introduced herself to my girlfriend. That happened earlier in the evening, so I'm drinking a lot that night because I'm looking forward to my life being troublesome in the near future. And I ended up passing out on the neighbor's lawn. And somebody called the police, and as the police are coming, my girlfriend comes and grabs me and tries to get me out of there. And I thought she was taking me away from the party. And we got in a fight that night, and I actually bit a chunk out of her head. And I don't say that as a dramatic story, but really, I have clear memories of what happened that night, and I thought she was taking me away from the party. I thought she was taking me away from the drink, and I couldn't deal with that fact. And that was years before I got sober. The fights with my sister were years before I got sober. This is a couple years back now, but a girl I had dated for about 3 years. When I had gone to college, we had ended our relationship, and I would come back from college. Sometimes I'd come back for weeks at a time, and I wouldn't stay at my house. I'd stay at other people's houses closer to home because I was just drinking at home, and we were kind of in and out of our relationship, and she ended up getting pregnant, and so for 9 months we argued about whose child that was, and the day that child was born, I went to the hospital to see To be honest, to this day, I'm still not sure what I went to the hospital for, other than the fact that, that's one of those things, those right and wrong things that my parents taught me. And I showed up in the hospital that day, and the name on the little bassinet in the room wasn't mine, and I turned around and walked out. And I've never seen that girl. I've never seen her in person again since. She continued to send pictures to my sister, and I've seen those pictures. But that's another one of those things that I got to drink at the end of the night to forget. I can't remember that this is who I am and this is what's going on. And by the end of my drinking, when I come to or I sober up, this is all the mania that's going on in my head, and I can't deal with it. I don't know what's going on anymore. And I go out on a Thursday night and I call my girlfriend and I said, hey, I'm gonna go to the bar with the guys and have a couple of drinks. That's pretty normal. We start drinking on Thursday night, and Monday morning I'm still awake and I'm still drinking, and I haven't been anywhere other than hanging out with these guys in a couple of bars and an apartment, and that's also not that abnormal. There's one guy left. We started off with five or six guys on Thursday night. There's one guy left, and I'm sitting on a couch, and I offer him some more of the stuff that we're doing, and he threatens me. He said, if you don't get away from me, I'll fight you. And one of the things I held on to at the end of my drinking is this is what I do with my friends. And even though I had to change groups of friends all the time, because if I'm lying and cheating and stealing your money and going after your girl, you don't want me around. But I still had this idea that I did this with my friends. And he threatens me, and that's not the first time that had happened either. But at that point, I do what I've done before, walking out of that exact apartment, as I grab the last six-pack of Miller Lite, and I get in my car and I start driving around, and I call my girlfriend. I mean, hey, I told her I'd see her on Thursday. It's Monday. Just give her a call. And I said I think I need some help. And she said okay. She said she'd come meet me. And I told her I'd drive to a park by her house. And I drive to a park by her house, and I'm sitting on a bench at a little softball field, and I sit there for about 5 minutes, and she's not there yet. And I go back to the car and I have another beer. I go back out and I sit on the bench and wait. She's not there yet. And I go back to the car and I have another beer. And she shows up. And by the time she shows up, at that point I was working for Home Depot, and I had called their employee assistance line, and I had them on the phone when she showed up. And I'm starting to tell them something, and she said, "Why don't you hang up the phone?" So I hang up the phone, and I don't think about all the little things that were really what I used to call luck that happened when I got here, but that was actually probably one of those lucky things. I had seen a lot of people in and out of that employee assistance program, and I have never seen one of them in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I got off the phone, and she was in a health class at a community college, and she said, "Why don't you come back to my house?" And we went back to her house, and she opened up one of the health books she had, and for some reason in the back of the health book were no phone numbers of rehabs. And I started calling these rehabs. And I called the first one, and they put me on hold. And I called the second one, and they put me on hold. And I don't know if anybody else here has been up for 4 days drinking. I was up for 4 days drinking, and hold was not an option for me. I didn't do well with hold, so I just kept hanging up. And I called another place, and the third place I called, they said, "You can come in. You can't be drunk or high when you come in, and you need your insurance card. And if you guys drank like I drank and you happen to have insurance, you didn't know where the insurance card was." I didn't know where the insurance card was. I also knew that I was drunk and high, so I said, okay, I can't go in today. And this is where, for the longest time, 2-3 years into my sobriety, I would tell my story and I would talk about all the lucky things that happened, and this would be one of those lucky things. And today I've come to believe that this is the grace of a higher power that I'm not here to explain. I'm not here to tell you what God is. I am here to tell you that a God of my understanding works in my life, and I haven't had to take a drink in a long time. But I went home, and I got in bed, and I pulled the covers up, and I laid in bed until the next morning when I had to go to work. And I got out of bed, and I went to work. And work was about a mile away, and I drove to work, and I turned around and drove home, and I got back in bed. And I got up the next morning, and I changed my shirt, and I drove to work, and I went to work, and I drove home, and I got back in bed. And I did that for 5 or 6 days, because work said that's how long it would take to get me a new insurance card. And I got the new insurance card, and I went to that rehab. And I showed up at that rehab, and I hadn't had a drink or anything else, and I had the insurance card, so I went in. And I'm not here to badmouth rehab. A lot of people get a lot of things out of rehab. By the time I was 27 years old, I had seen counselors, judges, lawyers, police, and people had explained things like the bell curve to me. They told me I should stop drinking, and this is what's wrong with you. Why don't you stop? So 7 weeks in this outpatient rehab, 2 hours a night, 3 times a week, I didn't learn anything. I learned absolutely nothing. But the grace that I got out of that is they said that I had to go to 4 Alcoholics Anonymous meetings a week to stay. And I felt bad enough that I was willing to go to the meetings. They give you a counselor in there that you have to talk to about what's going on. And the first time I had to go sit down with this counselor, honestly, the guy looked like, I don't know if anybody remembers He-Man. The guy looked like Skeletor. And he seemed a little weird to me. And now I haven't had a drink. I'm only like 10 days away from a drink. But while he's talking to me, I decide that he can't help me. And I get up out of his office, and I said, "Who runs this place?" And he was kind of perplexed, but he told me who it was, and it was Barbara Fielding, and he sent me to her office. So I walk through the office, and I find this woman, and I tell her, "I can't talk to that guy. Find me somebody else." And she kind of looks at me perplexed, too, and then she's like, "Hold on." She picks up the phone, and she's like, "All right, go around the corner and go into this other office." And I walk into this other office, and I walk in, and there's a guy sitting at the desk, and he looks at me, and he said, "How much does your shoes cost?" I don't know. I looked down at my shoes, and I had on one of my nicer pair of shoes. I don't know why I was dressed nicely to go to rehab, but I was. And I told him my shoes cost $80, and he pulled his feet out from underneath the desk, and he had on some alligator skin boots. He said, "Mine were $400. Sit down and shut up." Come to find out later, I came to find out a couple years into my sobriety that that guy died with 27 years of sobriety. But what he did in that meeting in his office is he pulled out Aware and Win. And he explained what Aware and Win was, and he told me how to find meetings using Aware and Win. And he gave it to me and he said, "Go everywhere until you find people that have something you want or say something you relate to." And I considered myself pretty smart, but I didn't understand either one of those statements. Because I didn't know anybody that had what I wanted. I mean, unless it was a drink. And I didn't relate to anybody unless I was drunk and then I could kind of talk to people, but I didn't understand. And I lived out in Rockville at the time, and I didn't want to see anybody I knew. So I looked for meetings in D.C., and he had explained what a closed meeting was. And even though I didn't think I was an alcoholic, I didn't want to hang out with other people that didn't think they were alcoholics. So I went to a closed meeting. The name of the first meeting I went to was Easy Does It, and I thought I could handle that. And there's a comedy club on Connecticut Avenue, just south of Dukemont Circle in D.C., and it's called The Improv. And I had drank in The Improv. And The Improv used to have Noon Alcoholics Anonymous meetings every day. That's where I went. And I show up there at noon in an AA meeting in northwest D.C. The people look a lot more like I do today than I did then. They're coming from work. They're in suits and ties. The women are cleaned up. They're dressed. They're dressed nicely. Everybody welcomed me. They gave me a phone list for the group. They told me I could call anybody on the phone list. They gave me a 12 and 12, and they gave me a big book. They told me to keep coming back. And when I walked into that room, I went and sat down, and I had on jeans, boots, T-shirt, hat backwards. I had 5 piercings at the time. I've got some tattoos. My dad is black and Native American. My mother was Portuguese and French. In addition to my drinking, I also told you I did a fair amount of drugs. I could look around that room and tell you why I was different from all those people. But when they started talking about drinking. They started talking about the mania that they would create through taking these actions in their lives. And they'd say they'd take some drinks and it would quiet their head down and it would calm their stomach. And they said once they started drinking, they couldn't stop drinking. And they had me hooked. Didn't matter what they looked like. They were talking about me. And I went back to that meeting the next day, and I went back to that meeting the third day, Another thing that I find pretty funny is I'm probably one of the world's worst drivers. I don't like rules. My sponsor would tell you I don't believe most of them apply to me. Every day I'd go to that meeting and I would park in a crosswalk, illegally in a crosswalk, and I would go to a noon meeting in D.C. Every day for 3 days I never got a ticket. I just came out and go home. I'd come back next day and park in a crosswalk. But I went to that meeting for 3 days, and on the third day, the next youngest person in that meeting suggested a different meeting I could go to. She said, "There's a speakers group up the street." And she said, "I think you'll relate to the people more there. Now, I heard the words she said, but I don't think she had any idea how much I related to the people in that meeting. I didn't look like them, and I may not have shown that I related to them. I probably just kind of gruffed at people while I sat in the back. But I listened to her, and I went up the street, and I walked into that meeting, and choir, I don't know if you've ever been to choir, it's a Thursday night meeting, and there's two doors in the back, and there used to be chairs along the back wall, and as a good newcomer, the meeting started at 8:30, so I showed up at 8:30, and I walked in the door, and there was an empty chair next to the door, so I sat down, and I ended up actually sitting next to Billy St. Dennis, and I sat down, and I can't tell you, I can tell you I sat next to Billy, because I remember he held my hand at the end of the meeting for the prayer, and I can tell you who one of the speakers was in that meeting, but I can't tell you anything else about it. A girl stood up to speak in that meeting, and she was a white girl from Hawaii, so I can start to tell you why we're different. But during her talk, she said that she, and I actually think she used the word hate. She said that she, in her early sobriety, she hated her dead mother. And you can't say that anywhere. You can't say it at a family reunion. You can't say it when you're hanging out with the guys at the bar. You can't say you hate your dead mom. But when my mom had passed away at 16, I hated her. She left me. Now, if you can understand the self-centeredness of that statement, if you can understand being in Alcoholics Anonymous saying, I need help with my drinking, and hating somebody who died as a result of their drinking, if you don't understand that, that doesn't mean you're in the wrong place. If you do, you belong here. But she said that, and she held her head up. And people thanked her for speaking after the meeting. And she said a lot more in her talk, but I could wrap my mind around the hatred she had, but I couldn't understand the rest of it. I couldn't understand how she could hold her head up. And I said the prayer holding Billy's hand, and at 9:31 I was probably in my car and I was out of there. And a couple days later I met another guy from my home group who got my phone number and then started incessantly calling me, and I hated that guy. And he called me every day and wanted to know about going to a meeting, and every day I had a better plan, and I knew what meetings I was going to, but the next Thursday he suggested that meeting where the girl had spoke that I related to, and because it sounded more like my idea than his idea, I went. And when I got there, he introduced me to his sponsor, and he introduced me to all the other guys that his sponsor sponsored, and I didn't know that. I didn't know that for a couple of years. A couple of years later, I looked back and realized that meeting probably had 170 people in it. He introduced, the only people he introduced me to were his sponsor and the guys his sponsor sponsored. He introduced me to the guys that he knew. And after that meeting, his sponsor and a couple other sober guys lived in a house together. And they said, we're gonna go watch some basketball at the house after the meeting if you want to come by. And I didn't have anything going on, so I said, sure, I'll go by. And I went by the house, and they're watching some basketball, and we're watching some basketball on the TV, and I'm listening to these guys talk to each other. Occasionally, they'll ask me questions. Why'd you come to AA? How long you been sober? Da, da, da. But they're not really too interested in what I have to say. And then they start peeling off one by one. A couple of them went home. A couple of them started to go to sleep. But, you know, they're working. They're going to school. They're doing things. I'm not doing anything. And then at the end of the night, I get on the phone in their living room and start screaming at my girlfriend. Because now it's been about 3 weeks since I've had a drink, and I feel miserable. I don't have the steps. I don't have a higher power. I don't have a sponsor. I don't have anything going on. I am crazy. And my idea is she ought to be making me feel better. So I'm pacing in their living room screaming at her. When I get off the phone, nobody says anything to me about what I just did. They said, look, this is the meeting we're going to tomorrow. Why don't you come meet us? And the next day, I went and met him at that meeting. After that meeting, back over their house, watched some TV. Guys start going to sleep. Guys start peeling off. I'm pacing in the living room, screaming at my girlfriend. It's about midnight. And I have the thought that I've always had up until that point in my life, which is, if you get a drink, you're going to feel better. And it's been about 3 weeks since I've had a drink. And every meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous I've been in, people have said, do you have a sponsor? I don't even know what a sponsor is. But at that point, there's only one guy still left awake in that house. And he's in the kitchen. And he's making a sandwich. And what I knew was he didn't look like he was thinking about drinking. It's the only thing I knew about my sponsor when I got him. 9 years later, he's still my sponsor. But what I knew is that night I was thinking about taking a drink, and he didn't look like he was thinking about taking a drink. So I don't relate to people who need to interview sponsors. It's not a lot of questions I got to ask. But I asked him, I said, I actually said, I don't know what a sponsor is, but people say I need one. Will you be my sponsor? And he asked me two questions. He said, can you call me every day? I said, sure, that didn't sound like it was too hard. Yeah, I can call you every day. I'm here to say that I have not called that guy every day. but he asked me if I could. I said, yes, I can. And the next question he asked me is, can you follow direction? Now, there's a lot more to my drinking than I've explained to you guys, but all of it leads to the same place, which is my life was falling apart. But when another man asked me if I could follow direction, I wanted to have a conversation. And we talked, we literally talked, and to this day, I don't know why he entertained me for so long, but he did. We probably talked for about 20 minutes, and at the end of 20 minutes, he said, how about to the best of your ability? And I said, yeah, to the best of my ability, I can follow directions. And I'm here to report to the best of my ability, from then until now, I followed his direction. And what I did is I started following him around. There wasn't a, Christian and I were also talking about this in part of our car ride up here. I can't say what's going to work for people to get sober. I can't say that a certain style of sponsorship is going to work for somebody. I can't say that doing something this way is going to work or doing something that way is going to work. What I can say is me doing this worked for me. And that's all I can really share with other people. And what worked for me is my sponsor didn't say, go home and read the book. What he said is, this is what I'm doing tomorrow. Why don't you come do it? And that's what I started doing. He had service at meetings, so I was doing service at meetings. He was the treasurer for the inner group, so I was the guy that carried the box in behind him with all the paperwork. He did things, and I did things. That was it. He lived in a house with other sober guys. That front door was always unlocked. Those guys would come home, and they would find me on the couch. And they'd say, what are you doing? And I'd say, I don't know. What are we doing? Because I didn't have anything going on. I knew that if I was left to myself, I was getting drunk. And they made it perfectly clear that I could always do whatever they were doing, that they were always available for me. And I was there. I was there every day. And all those guys are still sober today. One of them has since passed away. Mike didn't live there at the time. He was in Florida. But the four guys that lived there at that time are all still sober today. And they showed me how to do this. My sponsor showed me how to do this. In time, we did start going through the book. We went to meetings where step and tradition meetings and book meetings long before we started going through it. And then we started going through the steps. And I'm not going to walk you through the 12 steps as I took them. But what I will say is, for me, this stuff had to become my experience. And over a period of time, it did become my experience. And as it did become my experience, and I got the chance to try to share it with somebody else, that's when it became my conviction. The first time I sat down to hear a fifth step, and the first line of that fifth step was identical to the first line of my fourth step. There was a conviction there that I didn't have before sitting down and hearing that fifth step. And the time that I walked into a meeting and I sat down next to a guy that I sponsored, he seemed pretty calm and he seemed pretty okay, and he was explaining how terrible his day was. And I said, what'd you do? And he said, well, I got to the meeting and I looked for you and you weren't here. So he looked for another guy I sponsored and then talked to that guy. And knowing that that's how I used to show up at meetings, I would slide into the meeting and be like, where the hell is John? And John wasn't there, and I would grab somebody else that he sponsored and start dumping my chaos on them. And I started to realize in watching other guys do this, that this is what works. And I got actively involved in Alcoholics Anonymous long before I started taking these principles other places in my life. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, things got a lot better than they did other places in my life at first. But as I started to take these things into other aspects of my life, I was fired at a little over a year sober. And today, I've got a job through a series of acquisitions and companies and things like that that I've been working for almost 6 years. My father, who has never, I mean, I got spanked as a kid for being stupid, and I was very stupid, so I got a fair amount of spankings, but we were never physically violent with each other. At 9 months sober, my dad punched me. He showed up at work. We shared the same name. He's been served by the police. They say, is Cortland Wilson there? He says, yes, he gets served. They're looking for me. They're not looking for him. There's all kinds of stuff going on, but he showed up at the place of my employment with all these letters that were addressed to me, him, that had changed color and were threatening and things like that, and he punched me in my chest and dropped them on the floor and said, are you drinking? And that's at 9 months sober. That's because inside the meeting, I'm setting up the chairs and I'm making coffee and I'm welcoming you, but then I go home and I could care less about anybody else. So not until I started practicing these principles everywhere else did those relationships get better. My sister, who was terrified for me to be around my nephew when I got sober, if something goes wrong with him, they call her, and if they can't find her, they call me. All those areas of my life have changed. And when I lay down at night, it's generally pretty easy for me to go to sleep. I did not sleep for a long time at Alcoholics Anonymous. It's actually one of the jokes amongst most people that know me in my home group. I didn't sleep more than 2-3 hours a night until I did my 4-step. And then for about 9 months, I slept every time I sat still, including most meetings. But then after that, I also didn't sleep too much. But the more that I've done these things in my life, and the more that I've tried to get out of myself, more often than not, I go home and I go to sleep at the end of the night. And the sense of ease and comfort that I have today as a result of taking these actions in my life is truly amazing. It's truly amazing. There's definitely a lot of work that I've got ahead of me, and I only pray that I keep doing enough of this stuff that I got a long time doing this. But I'm definitely not the guy that walked in here almost 9 years ago, and I'm definitely grateful to be able to show up and share my experience, and I hope somebody got something out of it. And if not, I will let you know that coming out here and do this has helped me stay sober today, and I'm going to go home and I'm going to sleep well. So thank you.